and I'm happy to answer some questions.
And the basics fell out on civil liberties under the Obama administration with a lot of the supposed civil liberties, but the ACLU really seems like it's nailed it in over the last 5 to 7 years in particular.
Well, I would say I don't get much chance to talk to Democratic legislators. I certainly tweet and blog about those points, and I think it's a fair point, and it's not, you know, one of the things I remember writing about some years ago was, in front of the Cato Institute in Washington, there's some sort of official box, metal box about this size, has something to do with traffic signals, I guess. And every day during the Bush administration, there was always a poster on it summoning us to the next anti-war march. And I'm telling you, January 20th, 2009, the posters just stopped. There were no more anti-war marches, no more anti-war organizations. Now, to be fair, at the very beginning, they may have believed Barack Obama when he said, "I will stop this war in 2009. I opposed it in 2002, I opposed it in 2003, I opposed it in 2008, and I will bring it to an end in 2009. So, okay, during 2009, I give them a pass. They thought they got elected a president. But in 2010 and 11 and 12 and 13, where were those posters? I think that is a bad thing. I have to say, I think you're unfair to the ACLU. I think they've been quite forceful in pushing back against the Snowden surveillance revelations and pushing back against the surveillance that Snowden revealed. I think they're still pretty good on campaign finance regulation, free speech, and on campus free speech. Now, there are things the ACLU does that I simply disagree with. They don't recognize gun control as a violation of the Second Amendment. They think that there's a lot of entitlement that people are legally entitled to under the Constitution, and I think that's wrong. But I think on the civil liberties issues, as we understand them classically, the ACLU has been pretty good. The Democratic politicians have been very bad. You know, I talked about the polls, and one of the things you see in polls, and this is very disappointing, is if you ask people, how much of a threat is the government to our liberties? Numbers generally been going up. It seems like people understand that. But the partisan numbers can be very different. When Bush is president, high numbers of Democrats think the government is a threat to our liberties. When Obama becomes president, that number plummets, and the Republicans think government is a threat to our liberties. And the Libertarians, and to some extent the Independents, the number stays similar, because we think both parties are, and the government itself, are threats to our liberties. So I haven't talked much to Democratic legislators. And when we do, of course, we've had some contact with Democrats in Congress who actually are doing the right thing on some of these issues. Senator Ron Wyden and Senator Pat Leahy have both spoken at Cato conferences on surveillance. Senator Tim Kaine from Virginia came to Cato to ask why Congress does not insist on deciding when the United States goes to war. If the president wants to make war in Syria or Libya, he needs the authorization of Congress. Now, it's not clear that Kaine is against those wars. He thinks that it is incumbent upon Congress to take responsibility. And that's an important point, too. We talk a lot about executive arrogation of power to itself, and that's absolutely true, but it's also congressional abdication. Congress doesn't want to make these decisions. Congress is often happy to let the executive make the decisions. If Congress has to vote on going to war, then if the war goes badly, Congress will be blamed. And by the same token, if they vote not to go to war and things go badly, they might still get blamed. Hillary Clinton is still wishing there'd been no vote on the Iraq War back in 2002, because then she wouldn't have voted for it and lost to Barack Obama. So they deserve to be called out. I don't know that we personally have called them out directly as much, but I'm quite confident that if we had a chance to talk to them, they have pat answers in response to why they're not doing these things. Yes?
David, I guess the example you gave, most people will not do anything. You know, they're compromised, so they don't want to make a fuss. But to the Eastern to me, they had economic freedom wasn't there, they couldn't make their lives better. Political freedom wasn't there, they couldn't, you know, here's, like, you know, this government, they couldn't decide, here's how I want to change my life. You know, they had Stasi always looking at them, saying, here's the box you're going to live in. And we in America, you know, we had the same kind of thing with this, you know, Patriot Act trying to tell us, you know, where we can travel, how we'll be searched, and we have the people, you know, they don't want to, you know, they were not talking about living in Canada, whether they, you know, like losing their economic freedom, they don't have a job, or they're in poverty, or they think going through TSA checkpoints is okay because it's a theater for, you know, the anti-terrorism, you know, act to stop it, or, you know, that, you know, all these things are just comfortable, they don't move. So what gets people, and kind of like, to make them get out and say vote, you know, who, like other people, you know, basically will not vote, who want to come out and look, you know, is there anything that says here, you take what you're going to do, you'll come out and vote libertarian or, you know,
Well, you know, I tell this story because it should inspire us, and we should admire and really be astounded at what they did. But I don't want to be misunderstood. We don't live in East Germany. And clearly, they had higher costs for protesting, but they had something really important to protest against. And it is true that in modern America, we have a good deal of freedom. And we have a hell of a lot of prosperity. We could have more. And people who are poorer than most of us in this room would benefit especially if we had more economic freedom and more prosperity. But still, we have, as you say, comfortable enough lives that most people are not going to feel the same impulse that either the people of East Germany did or that those of us in this room did. And that's a challenge to us. And I think it's partly a challenge in terms of the way we deliver the message. Because if we say to the American people, it's like East Germany, it's like Hitler, we don't have any freedoms in America, I don't think they buy that. I don't think they think it makes any sense. And so we have to have a more finely tuned argument. We believe that all over the world where people try freedom, it works. Now, as I say, I also believe freedom is right. It is the natural condition of man. It is just. It is moral. But it's also true that we can see the empirical results. We can see the difference between East Germany and West Germany, between China and Hong Kong and Taiwan, between the United States and the Soviet Union, though that's a less good example because it's not the same country. East Germany is so classic. You took a people with the same language, much the same culture, the same history, the same government, and you put a wall down the middle and you said, try capitalism on one side and socialism on the other. And on one side of that wall, 30 years later, they had produced Mercedes and BMW and Volkswagen, and on the other side they had produced the Trabant, but you have to wait 6 years to get one. That's the difference between capitalism and socialism. But in this country, we're not facing that kind of situation, so I don't think we can use the same revolutionary appeals that might have worked in the French Revolution, the American Revolution, or that might have worked in the revolution against the communist empire if people had dared to stand up and give revolutionary speeches, which isn't really the way it happened there. So our challenge is to persuade people that there is a better way. One of the ways we reach people with that is to find some issue of freedom that matters to them. It might be gay rights. It might have been women's rights. And I have to say, I think libertarians missed the boat on civil rights and women's rights, and to some extent on gay rights, and Republicans missed the boat even worse, and they still don't understand why women and blacks and gay people don't want to vote for them. I don't want libertarians to be in that situation, but, you know, many of those battles have been fought. We can also find things like marijuana. Some people think marijuana is very important to them. To some people, guns are important to them. To some people, raw milk is important. To some people, it's the regulations that affect their business. I would think to most people it would be the taxes, and tax withholding is possibly the worst mistake anybody in public policy, certainly the worst mistake economists ever made, because there's no way the government could collect these kinds of money without tax withholding. Can you imagine saying to middle-class people, at the end of the year, now send in 25% of all you made during the year? I don't know about you, but a lot of people don't have
it. Yeah,
well, that would be right. Or move election day to April 15th. So, still, people don't like taxes. And one of the things Republicans have done over the past few years is take more and more people off the tax rolls, so that we really do have an incredibly progressive tax system. The people in the top half of the tax brackets, the income, are paying overwhelmingly all the income taxes. That makes it tough, too. I don't understand why there aren't 100 million members of the National Taxpayers Union. Everyone should be a member of the National Taxpayers Union. Only some people want to smoke marijuana. Only some people want to own a gun. Everybody pays taxes, and I assume everybody doesn't like it, unless they've been sort of, they brainwashed themselves, and no, I like government, so I'm in favor of it. So I think it's trying to figure out what kind of message would sell to people. Right now, unfortunately, it seems a message of being against Mexicans, against Muslims, and against Chinese imports is what's selling to a lot of people. We shouldn't go overboard. Donald Trump's getting 35% of the minority party's primary voters. That's not exactly a majority in the country, but still, it's a disturbing number. And Bernie Sanders got a message that isn't all that different. He's getting a lot of votes on that. I think you have to go to people with an optimistic, hopeful message about how things can be better that includes the point the countries that have gone the farthest toward freedom have been the most successful. If you've ever thought about moving to another country, it's not a country that is substantially less free than the United States. You may have thought about moving to Canada, Australia, maybe even France. France is arguably a little less free than the United States, but in the big picture, not a whole lot less free. So people know that the more freedom you have, and by the way, the Economic Freedom of the World Index is now proving this statistically. You can look and see what is the what is the correlation between economic freedom and standard of living, GDP per capita and so on. It's very strong. It's also a very strong correlation between economic freedom and levels of personal freedom and democracy. So that's part of the message that we want to get out. The freer a country is, the more people want to move there, and the better it works. So why don't we try being more free? I think that's the message we have to try. Yes?
Forgive me for getting a little bit on my soapbox here, but something I have seen, especially out of this administration, well, actually, it's probably been going on long before, but I've definitely seen it out of this administration, is the desire to control the populace as much as possible through whatever means necessary, be it healthcare, be it civil disarmament, you name it. I feel we here in this country could be facing what our brethren overseas behind the Iron Curtain, in Nazi Germany, or in communist China, could be facing. Do you think that we have something going for us that they don't?
Yes, we have a lot going for us that they don't. You know, it was a book a few years ago called Three New Deals. It was written by a German scholar, Wolfgang Schimmelbusch. And I wrote a review of this for Reason. And what it meant by Three New Deals was looking at the comparisons between Hitler, Mussolini, and Roosevelt. Talked about things that you might not think of. Giant public works projects. In Italy, it was the draining of the marshes. In Germany, it was the building of the Autobahn. In the United States, things like TVA. It also talked about how each of these three leaders had reached over the established institutions of society, including the political parties, to have a direct connection with the people that had been unusual in the past, and that was partly made possible by mass media. That's why it happened around that time. And I wrote this review, but at the end I had to say, okay, are we trying to prove too much here? Roosevelt seized a lot of power from the Constitution, from the states, and so on, that presidents had not had before. But he was not a murderous thug, and the institutions of the United States did not roll over and die. Businesses, not enough of them, but a lot of businesses still resisted that. Courts resisted him, and he tried to pack the courts, but he failed because Congress wouldn't go along with packing the courts. Politicians did resist him. The nominee of the Democratic Party for president 4 years earlier than Roosevelt denounced him for what he was doing. That's the sort of thing that wasn't happening in Germany or Italy. One of the interesting questions was why Schivelbush didn't include Stalin. Why wasn't it four New Deals? Because there were a lot of similarities. But he sort of explained, Stalin came to power in an internal party coup. He did not come to power by rising through a democratic process. All the others did, in some sense, and they came from outside. So I do believe, I said distrust of government is in America's DNA. I still believe that. I'll give you one good example. We have had so many high-profile gun tragedies in the past few years, including during President Obama's administration. Many Americans are horrified. All Americans are horrified at this. Many Americans think that what you do about this is pretty damn obvious. You round up guns. Certainly President Obama wants that. What's happened? Nothing. They haven't gotten anything through Congress because enough of the American people don't want to round up guns. In fact, roughly in the same time period, the Supreme Court has affirmed for the first time in history that the Second Amendment actually protects an individual right to bear arms. So I think that is a difference. And we still have political parties, we still have institutions, we still have independent media. The media are more pro-government than they ought to be, but at least we have some alternatives in the media. Now, a lot of people, including my colleague Walter Olson, have been very insistent that Donald Trump is something different in America and that there are elements that might be called fascism in both the program of protectionism and racial scapegoating that he's offering and in the style. I'm the guy who can fix it. I don't need policies. I don't need parties. Just put me in charge and I will fix things. That is the classic message of a demagogue, a fascist. And also now, the fact that he seems to generate, feed off, and profit from violence surrounding his activities. However, as bad as Trump would be, Trump coming to power here is not the same as Mussolini coming to power in Italy because we do have more robust institutions. So, no, I think we should be very skeptical of what the government's doing, but I'm not worried about ending up like East Germany anytime soon. Yes.
Thank you for trying to cheer us up, reminding us about the fall of the Berlin Wall. Let me try to cheer you up a little bit. True story. 2 days ago, a student in an engineering laboratory class, part of the job is to just put some kind of message on a display. It doesn't matter what. Usually they put their name on it, but it's stuck up to me, hi, Professor Grace. Yeah. 2 days ago, the message the student put on was, "Gov is dead." And he was from Greece.
Now, this is a public school?
John
Copy. Oh, okay. Well, that's probably better than I was wondering if he just misspelled God is dead. you know, this is kind of relevant to the previous question. 10 years ago, I was touring Charleston, South Carolina, just as a tourist. I happened to read in the local paper that Sandra Day O'Connor would be speaking at the Citadel, the military academy there. That might be interesting, Supreme Court Justice speaking here. My partner Steve was there, and he doesn't hang around politicians and judges as much as I do, and so it was more of an unusual thing for him. And so we said, okay, we're going to go. So we went there, and she gave a talk, which was kind of the conventional wisdom. Of course, when you're the swing vote on the Supreme Court of the United States, whatever you say is the conventional wisdom. So then they turned to questions, and unfortunately for me, they said, students get to ask questions first. As long as they're student questions, then we're not taking questions from other people. Of course, Citadel has several thousand students, so They got all the questions. And I noticed the first three or four questions were all libertarian. One was about, does the Second Amendment in fact support an individual right, not a collective right? Another was about the Fourth Amendment, which might have been a little more surprising at a Southern military academy. And I can't remember what the third question was, but that's a pretty good group of cadets at the Citadel. And that's why I think we have a military that, whatever flaws it has, the head of the military, or former head of the military, recently said American soldiers would not obey the orders that Donald Trump says he would give them. Now, we want civilian control of the military. We also want the military to obey the law. And it's a challenging political science question. What do you do when your civilian commander orders you to do something that is illegal under natural law, the military code, and international law? But the fact that he said they wouldn't carry out those orders is a sign that what we teach our military officers is a pretty good understanding of American law, and that's one of the institutions that does not always, in every country, protect liberty, but might here if necessary. Yes?
One of the things that took me a long time to learn, 1951, I was in a sociology class at Mill University, right off the farm, green as grass, and the doctor, Marx, said that communism would prevail because they didn't have to pay dividends, they had smart man planning. There was about 50 people in that class, so the class was huge in those days, and probably half a dozen or more were veterans of World War II. Not one person raised their hand. And about 25 years later, I realized that centralized government, as we know it, is a pretty new phenomenon. Germany was all principalities 150 years ago. Italy was city-state. Now we've got devolution going the other way in the UK, where the Welsh and the Scots say, hey, we want to get out of here. This was unheard of 20 years ago. I believe, because I took two World War II in a little one-room school with one teacher and five grades, and all I looked at each week was the Life magazine. I believe that we won World War II. Most Americans thought we won World War II. It was years later that we really realized that 85% of the heavy lifting was done by the Soviets, as far as diminishing the German army. But I think with the internet today, and I think you see with the Chinese communists, and even look at India. India copied Attlee and the British socialists when they got their freedom in 47, and they kept that till 87, and they actually lost ground. The population was grew faster than the economy. They finally looked over at their neighbor China and says, hey, we can't keep this up forever, these guys are going to be eating our lunch. They started reforming the economy and becoming a more, let's call it free economy, I like to say libertarian, individuals. And I'm working with four charter schools now, and this is our whole premise, is it's choice. The reason we do so much for 35% less money, and we excel, and we've got the majority-minority, every one of our schools, all four of them. The reason we're doing it is because the parents and the students and the teachers are all coalescing. And I went to an event Thursday night. And about 150 parents showed up. It was black month, you know, appreciation. And I think this is where it's going. I think you're going to see education. If Carson gets in as Secretary of Education, he alone will make major strides. There's a lot of things like that.
I agree with a great deal of what you said until the last sentence. Let me just comment on a couple of other things you said. 1951, people didn't yet know how bad centralized planning and everything was. I think that's probably right. You know, at some point, people became communists in the 1930s. That's not really a justifiable thing, and yet, more so than later, it seemed like an alternative. What we're doing here didn't seem to be working very well. We had a Great Depression. Why not try something different? But, you know, 1951. In the early 1980s, Nobel laureates like Paul Samuelson were still writing in their textbooks that all students read things like, one of the advantages of the Soviet system is they make full use of their manpower. You know, I mean, this textbook is still being sold until the day communism, the flag is pulled down. So it took some people a long time to figure that out. Now, it's an interesting question. We had plenty of dictators, oriental despots, absolute monarchs, things like that, in the world before the development of the modern technologies that made sort of totalitarianism possible. So in the 20th century, we discovered modern technology, modern communications technology, and the ambitions of people like Stalin and Mussolini could change things. Are we now moving away from that? Well, in a lot of ways, we have. The communist empire fell. The Nazis are gone a long time ago. If you look at the Economic Freedom of the World Index or the Human Freedom Index, you see gradual gains happening over the past 40 years. Will that also come with devolution? You mentioned Britain. That's true. There's some devolution going on there. Being an eighth-generation Scottish-American, I wrote a couple of articles hailing the prospects for Scottish independence. So far, they've had devolution. They haven't had independence. Now the British people are talking about withdrawing from the European Union, so that might be another interesting thing. There are secessionist movements at different places around the world. Scotland is one. Catalonia in Spain, Quebec, even some parts of California. Very few of them have succeeded except in situations of great turbulence like the breakup of Yugoslavia and the breakup of the Soviet Empire. So I don't know if we're in that. And it would be great if we could restore to the states the powers that they had at one point in the United States. Although, again, there is a political science tension there. One of the reasons for the increased power of the federal government was that some of the states were doing really awful things like apartheid regimes, and people gave the federal government more power to crack down on that. The problem is, just because you want a federal government that guarantees the rights of the Bill of Rights to every person in the United States and a republican form of government, which is also guaranteed in the Constitution, doesn't necessarily mean that you need a federal government deciding what the student-teacher ratio should be in every school in the country, or what the wetlands policy should be in every county in the country. And somehow we need to make that distinction. Fundamental rights are protected by our Constitution. That's not a prescription for micromanaging. So it's a challenge. I hope it'll turn out that there will be more devolution, and certainly the modern technology of today. One of the things that happened in the 1920s, 1930s, the new technology made it possible for one person to speak to the masses. Now we have technologies that are making it much easier for individuals to speak to each other, or indeed for any one of you to speak to the entire world that's willing to listen on the internet. I used to notice, and it's probably still true, that in countries with very powerful governments, particularly governments that ran communications technology themselves, there apparently was no difficulty in getting a radio or a television into your house, but there was a lot of difficulty in getting a telephone. And it always seemed to me technology might be a little more complicated because it's, you know, it is interconnected, but it's also true that a powerful government wants you to have a television. It doesn't necessarily want you to have a telephone so you can talk to other people without their knowledge. So it's the broadcasting that was pushed by these governments. Today we have all of this communications technology. It's making it possible for us to do our work from anywhere. So if you don't like the taxes in Maryland, many people can do their Maryland jobs from Florida or Texas. Many people can do their American jobs from Monaco or a South Sea island or whatever. So I think we'll see more of that kind of devolution. And it probably is the case, as bad as we think taxes are, it's tax competition that holds down the top tax level in countries around the world. And anybody in America who thinks, oh, it's unfair that these places like the Cayman Islands have these low tax levels, just remember, whatever your tax level is, it would probably be higher if the governments are ever able to squelch the tax havens like the Cayman Islands and Liechtenstein and Switzerland and so on. Although my colleague Dan Mitchell, who's one of the leading experts on tax havens, tax competition is the nicer way to put it, says, you know what the biggest tax haven in the world is? It's Manhattan. As bad as the taxes are in Manhattan, they're better than they are in a lot of other countries, including Europe and much of Latin America. So a lot of money is in Manhattan because the tax rates aren't as high.
One more question.
One more question? Oh, dear. By the door.
Much like our healthcare system emphasizes suppressing symptoms, treating symptoms rather than actually finding the cause of the problem, it seems like a lot of people nowadays, when it comes to drugs, they seem to think, well, just throw all the drugs in the trash, or burn them, and that would be the solution instead of finding out why people go to drugs in the first place. Or with guns, hey, let's just ban all the guns and cut them off to the people instead of finding reasons why people go out to shoot much people.
Well, that's a good question. I guess I've been working on that for a long time. I had an op-ed in the New York Times in 1988 titled Let's Quit the Drug War, and I thought we were going to make some progress back then. It took a long time. I do think we're seeing some progress now on that point, and I think if you make analogies to people, listen, a lot of people mess their lives up with alcohol. But we tried alcohol prohibition, and it turned out then you had all the problems of alcohol, plus the problems of poisoned alcohol, plus the problems of the crime created by prohibition. That's what we see with drug prohibition today. The basic answer to your question, I think, is that root causes are hard. I don't know what the root cause of mass murders is. I'm not even sure I know what the root cause of drug addiction or alcohol addiction is. So we study it. Scientists study it. They don't always agree. Mass killings in particular, they don't agree. So it's tough. Whereas it's an easy, simple answer. Stop the goods coming in from China that are destroying jobs in America. Shut down the drug markets, and then our kids won't get addicted to drugs. Have a $15 an hour minimum wage, and then people will not be working for a wage they can't live on. All of those things are simple answers, and they're wrong. But it's tough to get that across. So the challenge is to put these things into language people can understand and for people to care. And again, the problem that we live a pretty comfortable life is one of the reasons people don't care. Okay, I feel really bad, so I'm going to take this question anyway, but I'll try to keep the answer real short.
All right, thank you. You were talking earlier about the correlation between freedom and prosperity around the world. I do a lot of work in Baltimore City's urban area, and preaching a libertarian philosophy there is very difficult. That you talk to these people and tell them that the minimum wage is hurting them, that I'm in favor of getting rid of food stamps and the other social support systems. We had someone earlier talk about decreasing the state subsidies to education. How do you make the libertarian case to those who are poor in the United States?
Well, that's a good question. That's a real challenge. And it's also how do you make it to people who care about people who are poor in the United States? One answer is maybe we should talk more about the restrictions on poor people and on enterprise in inner city areas rather than simply what we want to take away. My colleague Brink Lindsay at Cato is writing these days about regressive regulations, regulations that have the effect of protecting established companies and keeping challengers out. So that can include things like the taxi monopoly. You know, in New York it costs, or it did cost, like $1 million to buy a medallion to drive a taxi. That's not very helpful to inner city kids, is it? Uber comes along, and Uber can bust that monopoly, and so we ought to allow people to use their own cars as taxis. We ought to make it easier for people. Some places you have to go to school for 1,000 hours before you can be a hairdresser. You know, I think the market can figure it out. I understand the idea that if you let people be brain surgeons without being licensed, you might just go to the wrong brain surgeon, and that could be really bad. But it's not that terrible if you go to the wrong hairdresser. It'll grow out. So we might just let the market work for hairdressers, for shoe shines, for those kinds of things, we might make it easier to open a bakery or a grocery. And some people talk about enterprise zones where we will lift these regulations in only the poorest areas. I don't really like that, because why should we only have enterprise in these areas? Why, if the regulations are stifling enterprise, why don't we lift them everywhere? But I understand the suggestion there. So I would hope you could tell people that the drug war is harming inner city communities because it is creating crime. It is making the money in the community flow to criminals. That's not a good thing. You don't want criminals to be the most successful people in your community. So let's get rid of the drug war, and then let's help people who are using drugs and want to get off drugs, but let's not try to do it through prohibition. So maybe we just focus on that. And school choice, absolutely. One of the things that keeps poor kids from being able to get good jobs is they get lousy educations. So whatever we can do to open up the school systems, whether that's charter schools, vouchers, I'd prefer tax credits because they give the school a little more protection from the government, deregulating the supply of teachers, moving the control of the schools from the federal government to the state government, back to the local level, and even to the community, the school district, make it easier to open alternative schools. All of those kinds of things, I think, would help people who are especially in need of help. And then maybe you wouldn't have so many people working at the minimum wage if they got a decent education in the first place. Okay, thank you all for your attention. Appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to take a little break, then we're going to have dinner, and then we will have the business meeting.